We made this.
The TARDIS Crew, a Doctor Who podcast for the We Made This podcast network. I'm Baz Greenend, and I'm joined in my adventure through time and space by my co-host and son Ben, the biggest Doctor Who fan this side of Gallifrey. How are you today, Ben?
Yes, I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. So lots to talk about, and this time we are discussing the Seventh Doctor and the infamous Cartmel Master Plan. So join us in this discussion is the host of Podcast 250, Darren Mooney. Darren, how are you?
I'm pleased to be here. How are you guys?
Yeah, great. Yeah, we always love talking Doctor Who on this podcast. That's why we do it. And it's always good to get guests on and kind of share the love as well. Before we get into the discussion, we'd like to delve a little bit deeper into the Doctor Who fandom with each guest on the podcast. So, Ben, you've got some questions to indoctrinate Darren into the TARDIS, haven't you?
Indeed, I do.
So, over to you.
Okay. All right, then. All right, go for it.
So, first one, then. How did you get into Doctor Who?
I'd be kind of like a blow-in with the new series fandom. I think I would have arrived roughly, I think, around the middle of the second season when I was in college. A lot of people I knew were watching. A lot of people said it was quite good. So I kind of dove in then because those seasons were relatively short, 13 episodes at the time, Darren says, taking us wistfully back to when 13 episodes was short. I then began to kind of delve into the classic series and kind of got into it that way. But I would have been an original kind of Tennant Rose era kind of fan of the show.
Cool. And then I think the next one's probably the most obligatory question you can ask. Who is your favourite Doctor?
Capaldi's 12th Doctor is the very obvious, easy answer there. I think the 12th Doctor's era of the show is a phenomenal accomplishment. I think it's a high in the entire run of the show. I think Capaldi's a phenomenal actor. I think he's probably the best actor to have played the role. I think his characterization is probably the most compelling characterization that the character's ever had. So yeah, I love it from top to bottom. But again, I love most of them. It's just a shade of degrees. And then after that, it's like Eccleston. And after Eccleston, it's probably Davison. Interestingly enough, it's probably my favorite classical series Doctor. So that would be kind of my top three.
Amazing.
Interesting. So obviously with this time with the podcast, we're talking about the McCoy era. So overall, how would you rate it? And what would you say is your favorite story of the era?
Of the McCoy era? I think the McCoy era is a phenomenal accomplishment, particularly when you consider where the show was at that moment in time, both in terms of culture and in terms of its own internal politics. I mean, obviously, people listening to a Doctor Who podcast have a good idea of what I'm referring to. We're talking about things like the cancellation crisis. We're talking about situations with the firing of Colin Baker. We're talking about things like Eric Sawyer kind of walking away with his script for The Ultimate Foe and Robert Holmes kind of dying in the middle of producing that story. And the fact that Cartmel kind of comes in as this guy who has no real experience outside of, I think, doing a couple of workshops in the BBC and writing a couple of scripts that got a little bit of attention. But you go to Cartmel's IMDb page and Doctor Who is the first credit on it. And he's kind of like drafted in to handle the running of this show that at this point is largely dead on its feet. There's an expectation that this show is not going to survive very long after this point. It's kind of on its last lease of life. And I think I love the Cartmel era and the Seventh Doctor era in large part because it really feels like it's using that opportunity. It really feels like the production team understand that they are not writing a populist mainstream institution of British television in the way that, say, the Robert Holmes era was, or the Williams era was, or, you know, even if you go back to the early John Nathan Turner kind of arrival of Peter Davison was. I think the writers working on this stretch of the show are kind of like writing by the skin of their teeth and trying to figure out what they can do with Doctor Who when A, arguably nobody is watching because everybody's watching Coronation Street instead, and B, the BBC is kind of just waiting for an excuse to cancel it anyway, so has no real investment in this as a piece of intellectual property that they want to manage to death. And so I think that the era is remarkably experimental, bold, and ambitious. And I think you can see that because it improves like dramatically. There are quantum leaps in the quality of the Seventh Doctor era between, say, Time in the Rainy, which is the first, or Time in the Rani, which is the first story, and Paradise Towers. Those barely seem like they belong in the same show when you compare them to one another in terms of quality. Then you go from like Dragonfire to Remembrance of the Daleks. And that's another sense of a leap of the show taking forward. And it's like, yeah, I can't believe these are two parts of the same show. And this is my very long-winded way of kind of getting around to answering your question, where you asked which of the McCoy era stories is my favorite. And I think there is a general sense of progress between the first and second of the three seasons, where the show is continuously getting better. I think the 26th season is a strong contender for the best season of Doctor Who ever written. Right up there with, I would argue, Russell T. Davies' first season. I would argue maybe David Tennant's, you know, final season, the fourth season, Matt Smith's first, and maybe the first two seasons under Capaldi as well. But I think that, like, if I had to pick one story, and this is the point where half of your audience punches the air and goes, yeah, he's going to do it. And the other half goes, that pretentious moron. I'm going to go with Ghostlight. It has to be Ghostlight. Ghostlight is the episode of the Cartmel McCoy era that, like, most embodies absolutely everything that I love about this era to death.
Yeah, it's a big story, and it's a bit of decisive as well. Yeah, is it brilliant? Is it pretentious? Is it both? I mean, that's what I love about Ghostlight.
Does it make any sense? That's the question.
I genuinely did not expect that answer. I thought you were just gonna be really normie and go Remembrance or Fenric or something, and then I hear Ghostlight, I'm like, yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly probably the most unique story of the era.
Yeah, this is where Darren kind of is setting up an argument that I'm going to have to continue to make for the rest of the podcast. Now, everything I say is filtered through the knowledge that I'm the dude who likes Ghostlight. Yeah.
I think there are a lot of fans of Ghostlight out there, actually. It's certainly one that gets a lot of kind of new recognition as time goes by as well. I think the first time you watch it, you're like, I have no idea what is happening. It's kind of good, but I don't know what it's about.
It's really atmospheric and moody, and it's got good themes and good character dynamics, but I have no idea why anybody is doing the things that they're doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think it benefits from rewatch, because after rewatching it a couple of times, you start to get a grasp. Oh, right. So this is why this is happening. This is the Doctor's plan and so on. And it is a good story, just a bit hard to get your head around.
Yeah, I think going to what we're going to be talking about, the Cartmel Master Plan and the ideas being seeded throughout those kind of particular final two seasons, and what would have happened if it hadn't been cancelled, you certainly see elements of that that would have been in Ghostlight, and things that were taken out of Ghostlight that would have had more relevance to the plan as well.
Yeah, I'm fairly sure Ghostlight was the final one they ever recorded for the classic series as well, so what a way to end it.
Could you imagine that was a finale?
Well, you say that. We'll get in a bit later to Lungbarrow, which is essentially the Ghostlight of Doctor Who books.
Yeah. I mean, the original plan, I believe, that Ghostlight originated as the story that became Lungbarrow. It was meant to be the Doctor going to Gallifrey and digging into his own history. And then because of, I believe, budgetary constraints, and I would argue perhaps for the best, it was decided to move it to a classic Victorian era mansion and to delve into Ace's past rather than the Doctor's. And I would argue that all makes Ghostlight better, but that's my hot take.
I think it's a good take, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think as well, what was really interesting as well, you talk about that, about Andrew Cartman coming in when Doctor Who is essentially in the death throes, and the fact that this is a legacy series, you know, the esteem that was there with Doctor Who for so many decades, really, and, you know, coming on season 24 of what is one of the biggest sci-fi shows out there. I didn't get the change. It was more cult than it is now in modern day, but certainly bringing in someone brand new is both bonkers, then maybe also suggests that, you know, what's the point? It's a show that's dying. We're not going to get anyone big, and we're just going to get someone in to kind of run it to the end. So it's interesting that Cartmel, you know, his first credit on IMDb is Doctor Who, you know, and the fact that it's miraculous how we took it from, you know, in the Sixth Doctor era. And, you know, I was just watching Delta and the Bannerman yesterday and thinking, my God, the quality from this story through to Ghostlight, Ghost of Fenric, Survivor, and so on. It's just...
Yeah, it's an incredible, like, just an incredible uphill trek.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, Delta and the Bannermen, I really like that story. Is it a good story? Debatable. Is it a whole load of fun? Absolutely.
And it's doing interesting like things thematically. Like one of the, and again, this is probably something to talk about. We talk about the broader Cartmel era, but I think one of the interesting things about the Cartmel era is it's engaged with these recurring thematic preoccupations. And I think, and again, I don't want to be too mean towards the Sixth Doctor era. I don't want to be too mean towards Eric Sawyer. I'm aware that there were things happening behind the scenes there. And every era of Doctor Who is somebody's favorite. And I don't want to be dismissive of that. But I think that if you look at like the Sawyer era, Doctor Who becomes, and like Barry mentioned this, Baz mentioned this, the idea that like Doctor Who is a cult property. Doctor Who, I would disagree with the idea of it, that it was kind of a cult property always. I think that like when you go back and look at the Pertwee era and you go back and look at the early Baker era, that is a phenomenal era. That's like an institution of British television. My parents, who are not sci-fi fans, like can both point to, like you can age my parents by asking them which one they prefer, John Pertwee or Tom Baker. And it's like, yeah, one of you is a couple of years younger than the other one because that's your doctor. But I do think that like, as it goes on, it does become what Baz said is kind of cult. And I think a large part of that is what Sawyer does in the mid 80s, you know, with the involvement of Ian Levine as, you know, fan coordinator and all that. He kind of pushes the show to be more insular and to look more towards itself. And so you start getting episodes that are like about, you know, resolving continuity issues involving the Cybermen is your season premiere. And like, you know, I mean, again, every story is somebody's favorite. I don't want to be too mean about this sort of stuff, but you can see why the audience is going, no, that's not really what I want when I tune into BBC's sci-fi flagship show. You look at things like, say, the production of like Trial of a Time Lord, where like they spend an inordinate amount of the budget on that season on the opening shot of the TARDIS just being taken into the station, which is just a way of saying, look, we can compete visually with something like Star Wars. And you're like, for Doctor Who, that money could be spent in so many smarter and better places than this model shot at the start of the show, at the start of the sequence, that doesn't really have any plot relevance whatsoever, but you think you're competing with that and you shouldn't be. And then you get to like, I think when you look at the Cartmel era is arguably more invested in bigger thematic concerns. And you mentioned Delta and the Bannerman. It becomes a show about nostalgia. It becomes a show about memory and about history and about looking backwards. Because as you point out, the show has been running a long time. Cartmel takes over in the 24th season. He runs the 25th anniversary season, the Silver Nemesis anniversary season, which obviously opens with Remembrance of the Daleks, which is a 25th anniversary celebration. And he takes it through the 26th. And you start seeing this thing through Cartmel's era where Doctor Who begins to intersect with its own history. So, you know, Remembrance of the Daleks, you have that famous inside joke where they cut to the television and the television is literally about to introduce the first episode of Doctor Who, which is the point at which Doctor Who's history catches up with Doctor Who. You have, you have this idea that basically the show has been running long enough that the Doctor can be traveling backwards through time and like interacting with the history of his own show. And I think that like Delta and the Bannerman is about like 50s nostalgia. Mm. And it's very much about deconstructing and exploding 50s nostalgia. It's very telling that the episode blows up the tourist bus that's taking a trip back to 50s holiday camps in Wales. And you have things like Remembrance of the Daleks, where you go back in time to the 60s. And instead of it being this kind of theme park version of a history where everybody's happy and fantastic and enjoying themselves and loving it, you instead have this acknowledgement that racism was a fact of life for people living in 1963 in Britain and obviously in America as well. And then you go to, season 26, where you have like stories like The Curse of Fenric, where The Curse of Fenric is fundamentally about deconstructing the idea that the British or the Allies were, you know, the heroes of the Second World War. It's about, you know, how a lot of stuff that happened involving the Allies during the Second World War was actually pretty morally dubious. And, you know, you obviously have the specter of the dropping of the bomb on Japan, for example, but you have like even like the firebombing in Dresden and things like that, which are very specifically evoked by that story. And even Ghostlight, which is about going back in time and exploring kind of this Victorian ghost story, actually begins like unpacking things like Darwinism and the idea that Darwinism is a pretty scary philosophy if you apply it in any way outside of like basic evolution. If you start applying it to things like society, it becomes deeply uncomfortable. And the idea that you're grappling with that today. And again, so much of the Cartmel era is about taking that nostalgia and applying it to the context in which the show was produced, because obviously this was produced during the Thatcher era. And Cartmell, you know, very famously went on Newsnight and said when he took the job of script editing Doctor Who, what he wanted to do was to bring down the government. And Thatcher really haunts these three seasons of Doctor Who. And you have this exploration of, well, yes, Thatcher doesn't exist. Thatcherism doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's a product of a larger historical movement and culture. And I think when you chart across the three seasons of like the McCoy era, you see the show making a very conscious argument that it goes back to things like the Victoriana of, you know, the toys in the attic in Ghost Life, the obsession with Darwinism and social evolution, and how that connects to like the social Darwinism of survival, for example, where you quite literally have the idea of predator and prey taken to its logical extreme. Sorry, that's a very roundabout way of kind of getting into like the meat of the Cartmell era. But I like that even something as seemingly silly and inconsequential and fun as like Delta and the Bannermen becomes like you can trace it back and go, no, that is that's a little pebble at the start of an avalanche that is what the show is going to say over the next 3 years.
I just find it funny how when you mentioned earlier that Attack of the Sidemen start season 22 as like fixing all the continuity issues with the Cybermen, yeah. Then like four stories later, we get the two Doctors, which throws in full force the whole continuity issue of season 6B.
Season 6B, yes. Well, yeah, but that's the thing, is like you get the sense that like the, and again, nothing wrong with it. I don't want to cast aspersions, every era is somebody's favorite, but you get the real sense when you watch the Baker era that it's a show that's being written for and by a particular type of Doctor Who fan who loves stuff like season 6B. And that's great. I kind of love fan theorizing as much as the next person. But what I like about like the era that immediately follows the Cartmell era is that like it feels like it kind of takes a step back. And this is kind of the interesting thing about the Cartmell master plan is that, hot take, I think the Cartmell master plan works infinitely better because it was never actually realized on screen. I think the best thing about the Cartmell master plan is that it never actually came through. Like what it did was it introduced this idea of questions and the possibility of mythology and the idea that 25 years or 24 years into the show, you don't really know who this character is. You think you do, but you don't. And I think that if the show had followed through and given answers, I think that might have undermined or kind of belittled or boxed it in. I think the implication that the character is not who he says he is the best part of the Cartmell master plan, or the best part of the year. It's like introducing the Who into who is Doctor Who at the risk of turning this into a Stephen Moffat episode.
Yeah, easily like the ending of Silver Nemesis, where it's all like raises all the questions.
Yeah.
And no answers,
so,
yeah.
Obviously, I mean, I think the Cartmell master plan is this kind of mythological idea in Doctor Who that was never realised. And I think because it was never realised, it stands out as this kind of endless possibility of what might have been, which I think can be quite exciting for fans. You know, you pondering over it, because I think the cancellation obviously stopped a lot of this being realised, but at the same time, do they want the answers? I guess the prime example is the Timeless Children. If you want examples on the Doctor's origin, are you going to be happy with that? And of course, we see the reaction to the Timeless Children in Chris Chibnall's Doctor Who, and you go, maybe we actually don't want those answers. And I think that's what's really interesting. If it had been realised on screen, there would be those who go, well, love it, it's brilliant. And those who go, it's ruined Doctor Who.
And then you see the similarities, but also you could pick up on the fact that Chibnall has stated Timeless Children was an idea he had in the 80s. So seeing the Cartmell master plan start to play out probably influenced a big part of that.
Yeah. I mean, Chibnall is very much an 80s doctor. Sorry to derail this into a discussion of the Chibnall era, which I'm sure everybody is tired of talking about. But Chibnall is very much a child of 80s Doctor Who. I would make an argument, and this is a value-neutral argument, I would make an argument that a large part of Chibnall's like creative process in scripting these three seasons of Doctor Who has been, what if I do Earthshock, but I'm able to afford more than five Cybermen? Like, it's about realizing like the potential of Earthshock. If you've gone back and you've watched Earthshock, it's like trying Doctor Who in like the very early 80s, trying to do something akin to Star Wars, trying to offer scale and spectacle and majesty. It's a Cyberman invasion fleet and an attack on Earth. And there's moments where the Cybermen emerge and they're, and you get the camera effect to try and create the illusion that there are dozens, if not hundreds of them. But again, you're working with the limitations of early 80s BBC production that don't necessarily always kind of stretch that, which is like understandable, part and parcel watching Doctor Who. But then you watch Chibnall's Doctor Who and it often feels like he's like, yeah, but what if Earthshock, but like, with an actual modern BBC budget, production value, and special effects. The most obvious one is, you mentioned The Timeless Children. It's the episode directly before that, Ascension of the Cybermen, where you get that sequence realized on an incredible scale. I mean, notably, even in, Once Upon a Time, or is it Survivors of the Flux? But you get that sequence where you have the Cybermen legions just marching in the distance in a green screen. Mm-hmm. And it's very much, it feels like Chibnall's like, yeah, no, I'm doing Earthshock, but with modern graphics and modern effects. And I think that's fair. And I think it's worth noting that, like, again, and this is where it feels kind of mean, and I don't want to pick on the Chibnall era too much, but very famously, his first engagement with like Doctor Who fandom is showing up on the BBC question show and like asking Pip and Jane Baker and complaining about like what he felt how the show had fallen short in the 80s. And so like, I think Chibnall is Chibnall's Doctor Who is very much rooted in this era of the show, I would argue. And I think, you know, for better and worse, without getting down a rabbit hole.
Yeah, of course. So obviously, I mean, a lot of people know what the Carter Master Plan is, but obviously, I assume not everyone listening to this will be as familiar. So Ben, do you want to kind of summarize what the Carter Master Plan is as a concept?
Yeah, it was kind of the idea of delving further back into the Doctor's origins, of him as a mysterious Gallifreyan origin figure, essentially, like akin to Rassilon and Omega. Like, there was a figure known as the Other, who was apparently the third one who helped invent time travel, which is hinted at times it might be the Doctor, and basically just raises the question that, yeah, you think you know the character, but literally you know absolutely nothing about him. And I think it actually works really well with McCoy's iteration as well. Because if you were trying to do this with Davison, it might fall a bit flat, for example.
Yeah. I think that's the thing about McCoy's Doctor, the transformation from the very clownish season 24 to that kind of dark manipulator you get in season 26. We've talked about already the staggering change over the course of those three seasons. What would season 27, season 28 been like had Cartmore stayed on with Doctor and McCoy for a certain period of time, and how Doctor would have transformed? You know, would we have got the Timeless Children circa 1990? I don't know.
Well, I mean, season 27 does exist, so yeah, we'll talk about that later.
Yeah, absolutely.
On Big Finish and various other forms, yeah, as well. It's like that aborted season that was kind of abandoned for Trial of a Time Lord, where they now all exist as kind of novels and as audio plays and stuff. So, it's that thing where it's the facsimile. You're competing. It's like Shada, which is like, and it's fascinating that Doctor Who, as a time travel show, has so many of these literal kind of what if and branching moments, where it's like, what if there hadn't been a TV strike and they had finished Shada? Would the Williams era have finished on a high with another Douglas Adams story? And so you can go back and you can like recreate it, and you're kind of, but with all those things, it always feels like you're not even chasing a memory, you're chasing the memory of hope, if that makes sense, or the memory of potential. And so you end up with this thing where you're kind of comparing it to this imagined object, and it's difficult to reconcile. Where I really like Shada. I really like the version of Shada that's produced with the combination of video and kind of animation. But I also, part of me is like, I feel like maybe it exists better as this imagined object in my head, rather than something that is actually like tangible, real, and on two discs of the season 17 Blu-ray box set, you know? So I think that is kind of interesting that you have that there. And again, I kind of wonder, and again, McCoy obviously gets a finale when you go into the movie. And I think that's a structural issue with the movie, and not to get into that discussion. But I think that like the movie does give you an ending for McCoy's Doctor, which is, you know, you understand then why when you know, Davies was like, I'm rebooting Doctor Who, he's like, no, I'm not bringing back Paul McGann. I'm starting with my guy. My guy is the lead from the start, because you end up bringing a lot of baggage if you carry that over. I like the idea of the Seventh Doctor and Ace just kind of wandering off into the sunset, in that, as Ben pointed out, hastily ADR'd final scene of Survivor when they realize the show was cancelled, because it gives you this sense of, again, of limitless potential. And again, you have the wilderness. And I love that, like, I love that after, and again, this is the comfort of, like, sitting where we are now, knowing that Doctor Who is going to be renewed in 2005, 2006, knowing that it's going to run for, at this stage, 13 seasons, that it's going to be a cultural phenomenon again, knowing that this story is going to have a happy ending. But I love that after the cancellation with Survival, the show branches off in so many different directions and possibilities, where you have, you know, four or five different possible ninth doctors, including, like, Rowan Atkinson as one of them, for example, Richard E. Grant as one of them. And, like, you have the tie-in novels, you have that sometimes contradict each other, you have the audio plays, you have the web plays, you have, like, web short stories. And I love that, like, it's just so much possibility. It's not really nailed down. It's not something that is concrete. And, you know, again, like the Timeless Children, where the Timeless Children is one thing. It's absolute. It's a fixed point, to use the language of the show. And it could only ever be one thing now. Whereas what I love about the McCoy era and the mythology of the McCoy era is that it can be anything, as Ben points out. It's like, you're not another Time Lord can mean anything. When you take it out of context, you haven't read Lungbarrow.
And apparently, it really does mean something. Literally, not a Time Lord.
I think we're definitely onto Lungbarrow and some of the kind of the season 27 and Wilderness Years as well. But let's kind of go back to the kind of beginnings of Sylvester McCoy's Doctor Who. So, I mean, when we discussed you coming on the TARDIS crew, you got the idea of Andrew Cartwell and deconstructing children's television. So, kind of, what was kind of the idea behind that?
I think one of the things that I absolutely love about Cartmell's Doctor Who is that it very much understands the register in which the show is working and the limitations with which it is working. So, and we mentioned this when we talked about, or I mentioned this, apologies, when I talked about, I shouldn't project onto you guys. If people are listening and angry, tweet at me. But if you think of, like, we mentioned Trial of a Time Lord, and we mentioned the kind of the Colin Baker era and the emphasis on continuity there, the emphasis on competing with Star Wars there, and that sort of stuff, and the idea that it's being written for fans by fans. And what I quite admire about Cartmell immediately kind of sweeping in at the start of 24 is that he realizes what the show is good at, which is kind of important when you're somebody working your first job and you've been thrown in the deep end. He immediately realizes that there are things that Doctor Who, in its current state, as produced by John Nathan Turner, can do really, really well, or at least, like, better than most other shows and better than it can do what it's been doing, arguably. And again, all that is subjective, and I don't mean to kind of dismiss anybody's fandom. So you look at Time and the Rani, which is the first script, and again, written by Pip and Jane Baker, veterans, tried hands at this point, brings back the Rani, brings back Kate Mara, and you have, like, it's very much a pantomime script. Like, you have at one stage, you have, like, the Rani pretending to be Mel at one stage, kind of dressing up almost in drag, as if goading the audience to go, oh, no, she's not. You have a supporting cast that obviously includes Bonnie Langford, who was a child star and who, like, is a British institution of British variety television. And again, a long history of Doctor Who kind of hiring those sorts of companions, right up to, like, Catherine Tate and Bradley Walsh. This idea of, you know, and obviously actors or performers who aren't necessarily dramatic actors first and foremost. And I think you can kind of see Cartmell glom onto the idea that Doctor Who is very good at doing that sort of broad, almost pantomimey television. And you jump almost straight immediately into something like Paradise Falls, where Paradise Falls is
Towers.
And, you know,
Towers.
Paradise Towers. Ah, damn, sorry.
Paradise Falls is a film or something.
Yes, but I've got, like, obviously my little filing system in my brain has gone horribly wrong. But you look at Paradise Falls and it's something like Paradise Towers, and it's they're both high. That's where the word association is coming from. But you look at that and it's something like High Rise, but for kids, where it's like Blue Peter does High Rise, where you have this idea of a dystopian and, again, very Thatcher influenced depiction of urban living, where you've got these tenement buildings which were designed to, like, house people and to offer, like, a functioning model of society, but which have descended into anarchy and chaos and violence. You know, again, all sorts of examples from history. Pruitt Ego in the New York is a great example as well. But you, instead of like doing that straight, you filter it through the lens of what is recognizably children's television. Like the Kangs, the red and the blue Kangs, like look like they're something from CBBC, very intentionally and very deliberately so. You start seeing more flamboyant kind of like characters like Ken Dodd, the variety show entertainer, popping up in Delta and the Bannermen. You have things like, I would argue, the introduction of Ace and Dragonfire, where like one of the big knocks or criticisms of Ace is that like she's a teenager who doesn't actually behave like a teenager. And that's, she's not a teenager. She's a TV show version of a teenager. She's like confined by the language of television and what television expects the protagonist of a children's TV show to act like. So she can't swear. She uses slang that no real teenager would use. So like wicked a lot. She's played by an actor who is at this stage well past her teenage years. She's very much imagined similar to Dorothy, where she's whisked away to this magical kingdom by what I think she describes the time storm as a tornado at one point in Dragonfire, to make that parallel kind of explicit. And you have this idea that like even the Doctor himself within the Cartmel era is kind of presented as almost like a children's entertainer. And you have like, I mean, any number of examples you can point to there. Remembrance of the Daleks, the fact that he's on television, the fact that McCoy, you know, very famously a circus performer. We should be very clear. I don't mean like a juggler. I mean, again, the hammering of nails into parts of anatomy, the running of ferrets down paths. But he was a very much an entertainer more than an actor, a kind of a performer in that sort of way. And you have this idea of kind of things like taking the language of children's television and making it dark and weird and confrontational. And like, say, the Happiness Patrol from his second season is perhaps like one of the great examples of that, where like the language of the Happiness Patrol is like a children's game show run amok, right down to like the fondant surprise, which is basically gunging. For anybody who has watched 80s or 90s children television, like that is just gunging, yeah. Where you get a celebrity and you drop goop on them. The Candyman, you know, who never appeared again because Bertrand Bassett threatened a lawsuit. But he's very much a kind of a cartoonish, larger than life children's television character, in contrast to like more traditional Doctor Who monsters, which tended to be more monstrous, for lack of a better word. Things like The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, where it's quite literally about performing as a circus. And then you have this interesting juxtaposition of the Doctor, who is presented here as this kind of entertainment figure for children. And we should note that this has historically been the case. I mean, the original mandate of Doctor Who was to be an educational program aimed at children. The Doctor was meant to be a kind of a teacher figure who would teach children alternately about science and history. And then the Daleks were introduced and it's like, no, monsters and history. That's what the show is going to do. But you have things like, say, this interesting and repeated paralleling of the Doctor with figures from classic British kind of like children's pulp adventures, and kind of like Victoriana, if we're being quite explicit. So like to pick an example, in Ghostlight, that opening shot where he materializes, I believe it's in the attic of the house, but where you get this panning shot across all these toys that belong to children, as if to say the Doctor is almost like this kind of Victorian wanderlust adventure figure. You have things like the juxtaposition of the Doctor and Ace with other like companion and traveler analogues. And the most obvious one is like T.P. McKenna as Captain Cook, for example, in The Greatest Show in the Galaxy, where he has taken, is it Mags as his companion, who's like actually a werewolf. And you have this kind of juxtaposition of the relationship between the two of them. In Ghostlight, for example, you arguably have the situation where you could compare with Josiah and Control, for example, where, you know, Josiah's got this woman that he keeps as a captive, and like she has to kind of break free of his influence and his control, or Light, if you want to go like that, this kind of extraterrestrial entity. And you have this idea that, you know, the show is engaging with the idea and the history of Victoriana and the stories that we tell about children. And so you get this interesting thing happening where Ace, who is presented initially as this very teenage CBBC protagonist, ends up going on this journey that is remarkable for that sort of character, where She has this like sexual awakening in Curse of Fenric, for example. She has this confrontation with the Doctor in both Ghostlight and Curse of Fenric. And then finally, like, again, you know, in a way that I know, as kind of as Ben pointed out, this wasn't intentional. The sequencing of the final season was accidental. The way they shot it was not the way that they intended to be released, but such is life. But at the end of the journey, in the final episode in Survival, they drop these characters from what looks like children's television into a very recognizable, very grounded, like basically the real world, an urban estate in the middle of the Thatcher era. So you get this interesting juxtaposition of the language of children's television with the reality of Britain in 1989 that I think is really the key, or at least for me, is like a key part of the appeal of kind of the Carmel era as a whole. Sorry, that was a long ramble. I apologize if it made no sense.
No, that it really does. I also just want to look at season 24 and a bit of season 25 together. Because you start season 24 with, as you said, Time in the Rani, which as you said, is like a real pantomime CBeebies, like the Doctor in the rainbow coat falling down the stairs and the Rani dressed as Mel. And then you have the pink bubbles that just fly around in the disco ball of doom. Yeah. But then immediately in the next story, Paradise Towers, while it is still quite silly, you do have slightly more depth already showing where it's going with like some, while it's played for laughs, cannibals are there, which does that. But then I think most importantly, the Doctor with the caretakers, when like he's basically quoting the rule book at them to get out of the situation. It's the start of the really manipulative Doctor, which then will carry into Delta and the Bannermen when, at the end of part two, he's basically just yelling at Gavrot, and then ultimately leads to Dragonfire, where he starts going on his own mission, keeping secrets, has an ulterior motive for keeping Ace there, and also dangles himself off an ice cliff for some reason, because it's an iconic moment.
A literal cliffhanger.
But across season 24, you can already see that, and he's almost conditioning Mel to leave him because he knows what he's got to do. He needs Ace because she's a pawn in the game with Fenric, and Mel is not going to be able to be a part of that, so he's pushing her away so he can continue on his mission.
I think it's interesting. Season 24 is not a great season of Doctor Who, but there's some really good stuff in, I think, in that season. And I think you're right about the growth over those four stories with the Doctor as a dark manipulator that always starts coming pretty quickly as well, which then becomes more apparent as the show progresses. I think the other thing that's really interesting as well with season 24 is that, yes, it's silly and over the top and very much pantomime, but I think it also gets to at the heart of what the Doctor audience is in terms of it's actually family and there'll be children watching. And I think certain elements, particularly with the Sixth Doctor, elements with the Fifth Doctor as well, where it becomes so dark and violent that it's like, I know the whole May White House debate that went back as far as Tom Baker's Doctor Who, but I think when you really get to acid baths and people being gunned down and stuff, in, you know, in these things that you saw in the Sixth Doctor, you think this is really nasty and dark and violent. And it's not, you know, Doctors always have action and peril in there, but there's almost a maliciousness to some of that violence that seeps through those later stories, which isn't really almost appropriate, really, for, you know, for some of the younger audience watching. So one thing I do like about season 24, as much as is a bit too pantomime for my liking, is that it's getting back to kind of being a bit more magical and a bit more fun and a bit more flamboyant in the way that it's going to kind of attract the kind of broader family audience too.
Oh, yeah, easily. Like, because the thing that kind of started from season 21 and across season 22, maybe a bit of season 23 as well, because you have stuff like Frontios with the people being mashed into these machines at the end, which actually had to be rewritten because they deemed it was too much. And then you get Resurrection of the Daleks, which is like one of the bloodiest Doctor Who stories of all time. And then Caves of Androzani, which then follows into essentially Attack of the Cybermen, which is also quite violent. And then Vengeance on Varos.
Crushed Hands,
Yeah, it's just, it does go a bit far. And then Revelation of the Daleks is another example of that, where you basically get a little body horror Dalek in it. So season 24 knows what it's going for and makes it into a more family-friendly feel again.
I mean, it's also worth noting that, like, at the time, this was around the time that Star Trek The Next Generation was, like, launching and was coming to the UK and stuff. So it's like, there's a real sense of, I would argue, and again, this is not a discussion of the Graham Williams era, but I would argue that one of the big haunting, like, shadows hanging over the Graham Williams era is the question of, like, what does Doctor Who look like in the era of Star Wars, where audiences are going to the cinema and they are seeing sci-fi and it looks like that. And a large part of, like, under Williams, there's this tension between, well, okay, maybe it's a comedy, maybe that's the answer, or maybe we try and do some of the mythology stuff and we end up with shows like Horns of the Neman or Underworld, and they don't really work. And I think that, like, what's interesting is you have Cartmell doing this at the time when Star Trek The Next Generation's arriving, and Star Trek The Next Generation looks really great, whatever you could say about that first season. Yeah. And it's the bumps that it hits along the way, it looks amazing and stunning. And I feel like, as kind of Ben said there, like, things like the little bubbles or the pantomime quality of Time and the Ranny, they kind of make the show feel different. It doesn't feel like it's trying to compete with these beautiful model shots of the Enterprise D and this kind of, like, soaring atmospheric score. And I think that's kind of important as well in terms of, like, explaining why Doctor Who looks and feels like it does in kind of season 24, perhaps.
Mm. I feel also then, if we move on to season 25, it's quite an interesting one because it's like half and half, because you keep some of the kooky, weird themes like the Candyman, who is an iconic villain, or Greatest Show in the Galaxy, and you mix that into stuff like Happiness Patrol, which is all Thatcher takedown, and then you have the Doctor scene talking the sniper out of shooting him, and Remembrance of the Daleks having a civil war and Nazi allegories and racism and all that in there. It's a big fusion of season 26 and season 24 mashed together, which really paves the way for where they were hoping to go if it wasn't cancelled, and it does really work.
I do have a soft spot for season 25. I think, like, take out Silver Nemesis. I think Silver Nemesis is a strong contender for the weakest story of the era. And this is saying something for an era that includes Time and the Ranny, perhaps. But I think that if you discount Silver Nemesis, and even Silver Nemesis has some interesting ideas, it's the point where you get the, I'm far more than just a Time Lord, I think is the line from Nemesis, or is that more than just another Time Lord, whatever the line is. You also get things like the implication that, you know, there are Nazis, and the idea of the legacy of the Second World War, which obviously plays into things like Curse of Fenric, which is the point at which the show begins engaging with the legacy of the Second World War. But I do think that, yeah, I think, like, if you take Remembrance of the Daleks, the Happiness Patrol, and the Greatest Show in the Galaxy, that is a phenomenally strong season of television, I would contend. And saying and doing really interesting things with Doctor Who. And I think, like, leaning into surrealism with the Happiness Patrol and abstraction with the Greatest Show in the Galaxy, where the Greatest Show in the Galaxy, like, often feels like it's as much a part of the 25th anniversary celebration as Remembrance of the Daleks, because the show is almost working through its relationship with itself. Because it's like the climax of the Greatest Show in the Galaxy is the Doctor performing before the gods of Ragnarok. And they don't look like, Osiris. They don't look like the villains from the Pyramids of Mars. They don't look like Sutek or anything like that. They look like a middle-class British audience, two parents and two kids. And it really feels like you're watching the writers of Doctor Who kind of working through what it feels like to have to continually validate their existence to an audience, a presumed audience of people watching on the BBC at home when this is airing. And I think that's kind of, it's interesting to see the show engaging with itself in that manner, like in a way that isn't like, here's a bunch of stuff you remember, like the Cybermen or references to stories that we told 20 years ago. Here's a story about Doctor Who that's told entirely through metaphor and allegory. That's about Doctor Who, but not about the continuity of Doctor Who, if that makes sense, which I think is kind of a really cool way of doing it, perhaps.
Yeah, easily so, because you have that stuff like imperialism, again, is a theme in that story, and colonialism, and you couple that with the Doctor turning something into a snake with his hat and regurgitating booze to entertain the gods of Ragnarok. It's a very split story, which really is just what the rest of the season is, because every story has some sort of theme in there, especially. And it does surprise me, actually, that Silver Nemesis is what they decided. Yes, this is going to be our 25th anniversary story, because it does have the hints of the Doctor's origin, but then Remembrance literally has a reference to Doctor Who within it, and it's Dalek Civil War, so it's just a bit of an odd choice for me.
Yeah, Remembrance of the Daleks, as well as being a great story, yeah, I think is the perfect 25th anniversary celebration, because it's not a multi Doctor story. You know, they're not going to bring back old Doctors, maybe because it wasn't the death throes, you know, maybe we weren't so confident on that, but it's got that allusions back to the origins of Doctor in 1963. It's got things like Omega, the Omega references. It's got the tale of Davros and Daleks, and it's big and fun, but it's celebratory, and it really feels like it's playing with Doctor Who. We know about the Daleks now in the sandbox of the Unearthly Child, which is great. And I think that for me is what makes a really good anniversary episode. You get great ones like Day of the Doctor, for example, is a massively wonderful celebration of Doctor Who. You know, elements of the Five Doctors and Three Doctors have certain elements of that, but they also feel a little bit like too much, let's get Doctors in there. But I think, Remembrance of the Daleks is the perfect anniversary special for me.
I think what's great about Remembrance of the Daleks, though, is that it could be somebody's first Doctor Who story. Mm. I love Day of the Doctor. I think the Three Doctors is fascinating. I have a great deal of affection for the Five Doctors, but I cannot imagine showing any of those to somebody as their first Doctor Who story. No. Whereas I would have no compunction. Somebody's like, I want to watch a Doctor Who story, and I wanted to include Daleks because they're essential to Doctor Who. I'm like, yeah, Remembrance of the Daleks. That's the easy one. Genesis is far too long to recommend to somebody as their first Doctor Who watch. So Remembrance is just right there. And I think that's kind of amazing that it's like you watch it as a fan and you watch it as somebody who knows the history of the show, and you're like, oh yeah, I get this. It's Trotter's Lane. It's, you know, 1963. It's the Unearthly Child, as you point out. But you watch it as somebody who has no knowledge of any of that going on. You're like, yeah, it's 60s Britain. That's what's going on here. And I think that being able to balance those two things, and again, it Ben's entirely right. It's the balancing of those two competing ideas, those two extremes, that I think is like a large part of what makes it so fascinating. Again, that cliche argument about like, what is genius? Genius is the ability to hold two competing ideas in your head at the same time. And I think you see a lot of that in the Cartmel era, where it's like, we're engaging with the history of the show, but we're not doing it in a way that locks anybody out. Not that anybody is watching at this point, but like not in a way that like makes it feel insular or kind of isolated. It's like, if you get it, it's fantastic and you're welcome to get it. But if you don't, there's also a really cool story in here about like 60s Britain and how nostalgia isn't always everything that you think it is. And how, as Ben pointed out, you're dealing with the legacy of things like imperialism and colonialism and all this sort of stuff, and racism and Nazism within the context of British culture. So yeah, no, I like that's the beauty of it. Like, again, sorry, I feel like I'm rambling and raving too much about this. that is kind of like what draws me to it.
Yeah. I think as well, you know, Remembrance is great. I remember, which is, it's bizarre. It's almost a jumping on point for sure. 25 years in on the verge of cancellation, but you could actually go, particularly if you wanted to jump into Classic Doctor Who, you know, where do you recommend? Probably you want to maybe start with Tom Baker's Doctor Who. I don't know. So, but you could, if you wanted to sort of softly launch someone into watching Classic Doctor Who, start them with Remembrance, let them watch the final two seasons. You see how well it transitions into Rose, and then you go back and explore more. It's a really wonderful jumping in point, and it's great, and it's fun, and it's cool, and it has great Doctor Who moments. You know, you could argue the destruction of Scarrow is the one of the big parts of the Time War. It works retroactively. You know, it's got the Daleks current hovering above the stairs that for the first time, and it's like it's real big. It's a really cool moment, and obviously we played that in Dalek when they brought back Doctor Who as well. It's got some really great fun cool moments, and it's also, it works as that introduction to the classic here without feeling too far removed from modern Doctor Who too.
Yeah, which I think is a huge part of the appeal of like the Cartmel era in general. Like I would argue my first classic Who story was Earthshock, and I think that was a mistake. I understand the appeal of Earthshock, but like when you're easing yourself into Doctor Who, you want to like dip in like a warm bath. I think my second attempt was Caves of Androzani, and that worked a lot better. But I think the one that really grabbed me was I got Curse of Fenric, And the Curse of Fenric DVD, and again, this is something to talk about some other time with somebody who knows far more than I do, but like, you have all these different versions of Fenric, and you have like a TV movie edit, and you watch the TV movie edit, and it moves like a modern two-parter. It moves like something like, ironically, Family of Blood or Human Nature, given its ties to the McCoy era, but something like, you know, the Empty Child of the Doctor dances. It moves like kind of one of those two-parters in a way that is really accessible. And as you point out, like, you could go, and with no offense to the TV movie, you could go straight from Survival to Rose without missing a beat. And that, like Perryville, like, which is a real place that exists, going from that to the Powell estate is like just organic. It just feels natural. It feels like a logical step for the show to take. It doesn't feel like you've waited at that stage 16, 17 years. It just looks like, no, this is where it makes sense for the show to go from here. You could tell me that it was always intended to go that way, and it just works beautifully. So yeah, I think that's a very fair point.
Absolutely. And I think it's also interesting, the choice of companion as well. The choice of Ace, there was talk of possibly Ray from Delta and the Bannerman as well.
Yes, I think there was an either or. Yeah.
A little bit similar in a sense to Ace as well. But Ace is, you know, the way it explores her storyline and the way it kind of, there's a lot of focus on her as a companion. She has her own agency as opposed to just being the person that travels with the Doctor, is very much a modern Doctor Who companion trope. And yeah, the way it subtly shifts to focus a bit more on the companion, and the companion has a story in itself. And then, yeah, you go into Survival. What's one thing that's great, so great for Survival for me? I didn't really watch Doctor Who religiously as a kid, but I remember moments of classic Doctor Who. I remember the herbivores. I remember the two girls coming out of the sea with the claws. I remember the cheetah people on the horses. There are iconic images that stuck in my mind. So going back and me watching that was actually, it kind of triggered memories of my own childhood, you know, when I watched some of the McCoy stuff. But what's really great about Survival is that it's Doctor Who in a contemporary setting, in a very urban setting, with a companion who is grounded to the urban setting. And that's exactly what Rose is about. So you're completely right. You could watch Survival and go, well, the next evolution is, let's just rejig it and reframe the reintroduction of Doctor Who from the companion rather than Doctor, which is what they do in Rose. And it's a perfect continuation of the themes that are running through the latter seasons of Doctor Who.
I want to ask, like, this is probably a question for yourself or Ben. You probably have a much better idea of this than I do, but I'm just running through my head going backwards through the show, right? When, before Survival, when was the last time the Doctor was in contemporary Britain? Was that Attack of the Cybermen, possibly? And like, when was the last time that it was a major part of like the story that the Doctor was in our world? And by our world, I mean like the world in which, you know, we live, kind of like the UNIT era. Would you have to go back to Modern Undead for that? But even then, you have like the continuity issue of the Brigadier. Like, before Survival, when was the last time the Doctor was? I suppose Silver Nemesis, some of that has to unfold in the present day, right?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my brain wants to mention something like Sharda, or before that, maybe, depending on when it's set, Image of the Fendal, possibly.
Yeah.
Something back then, really.
I think you saw more of it in the McCoys and the Erudia before. You know, he did come to contemporary, not say Britain, like, for example, City of Death, he's set in Paris. Yeah. But it's obviously contemporary. But you know, there are very few times, I think, when you really, really see it after he heads off his TARDIS in Robot and doesn't really look back from, you know, a UNIT pop-up occasionally, but really he pops in as a visit on things like Terra Zygons and Android Invasion, but really it's brief interludes. He's moving further and further away. But whereas with the McCoy era, you get, obviously, the final season, Battlefield has...
That's a few years ahead.
It might be two years ahead, but it's close enough to modern
contemporary
Britain, I think, in that sense, even though maybe a couple of years ahead. And you're right, and then you've got Survival as well, but it's probably a few examples, but not that many.
And like, and because like, it feels like it's not just a modern setting. It's not like the Doctor is going to a nuclear power plant and that just happens to be set in the modern day. It's not, you know, the Doctor's going to a quarry in temporary Britain, or it's not like we're moving the production to Paris for production value, so I guess this episode is set in Paris in 1979. It is really like, no, it's this is Britain in 1989. And like, it's very explicitly, like, it's very explicitly Thatcherite Britain, where you have things like the shopping center, where you have the two guys stacking shelves, as if Pale and can't remember the two comedians who are stacking shelves.
Hale and Pace,
yes.
They were a big part of my childhood, absolutely. They were on TV all the time. And again, in children entertainment aspect, you know, they were always on there. So for me, watching that again, like, that's, again, memories of childhood. Even the set in Perivale, first 8 years of my life, I grew up in Kent. And I look at Perivale and that feels like home to me. It's so wonderfully evocative of the childhood and of the present day time when we've been watching Doctor Who.
And they bump into, I think, Ace's friend, who's like, yeah, no, everybody's gone. And obviously, like, in the context of a Doctor Who story, they've gone to a cheetah planet to be hunted as prey. But, like, in the sense of, like, you're watching this in 1989 and it's like, yeah, no, all the young people from this estate are gone. You're like, oh, that's real. That feels like a very real commentary on the community in which, you know, I'm growing up. I would have grown up in the 90s, but we would have a similar deal in my part of rural Ireland where it's like, yeah, no, the young people are just, they're gone. They just disappear. We don't know. Well, we do know where they all go individually, but we don't know why, or they seem like they just, like, one day up and leave and nobody really talks about them anymore. So it has that kind of, like, grounding of the old. And again, this is the thing that Ben mentioned, and I love that we keep coming back to this. So thank you very much for that. But it's like, it's the fact that it has its feet in two worlds simultaneously, and, like, literally in survival two worlds, it's contemporary Britain and the planet of the cheetahs. But, like, the cheetah planet is very explicitly Planet of the Apes, but with cheetahs, as Baz said, down to the cheetahs riding on horsebacks, down to the fact that they're actors with masks that have kind of animatronics that are, you know, I think the cheetahs actually look really good today, but
I love them. Yeah.
But I think that they're very much like kind of like late 60s, you know, style kind of like monsters or aliens. And so it has this feeling of, and again, it's this thing where it's like we mentioned with Remembrance of the Daleks, where it's like, it's something that is tied to the show's history iconography and, like, fans understand and place it in a particular context, but also easily accessible to anybody watching it in the context of British television in either 1989 or 1988, where obviously Perivale is like, oh yeah, it's Thatcherite Britain. It's a commentary on Thatcher's arguments about, like, the market and how there's no such thing as society and how life is basically a social Darwinist struggle. And I love, by the way, that, like, as a theme, like, Cartmell keeps coming back to the idea of social Darwinism as monstrous and grotesque. Like, it's there. It's obviously there in you know, Ghostlight, where you have this idea of evolution and the idea of apex predators. And I love the idea of Josiah being like, I'm going to kill the queen because that will prove I am the best person on this planet by, like, social Darwinism, by evolutionary standards. If I can kill the queen, I am better than the queen, which I kind of love. And the idea that is a commentary on some of the logic that drives kind of like the free market 80s kind of Thatcherite Britain. And then you have, obviously, we mentioned things like Curse of Fenric, where, like, the idea of human evolution is building towards the hemivores, which is this monstrous blood-sucking parasite that can only survive by feeding on people. And then, obviously, like, you get to Survival, where you have, like, this community where people are literally being transformed into predators feasting, like feeding, literally feeding on the weak among us. And, like, that being a piece of commentary about, like, where Britain was in 1989. But on the other hand, you also have, but here's a homage to, like, late 60s science fiction that overlaps with the launching of Doctor Who, where, like, if you were watching An Unearthly Child in 1963, you were probably going to the cinema in 1968 to see Charlton Heston in Planet of the Apes. And I love that, like, the show is aware of its own history, but not in a way that feels like it locks people out, but instead just feels like, no, it understands that Doctor Who is 26 years old, and that history includes science fiction that dates back to Planet of the Apes, but we're doing it with cheetahs. Like, I love that.
Yeah. And I think then, if we, like, with season 26, it's also telling with the direction the show's trying to go, that, like, the Doctor's jacket, it changes to really dark brown, and we get resolution to why the Doctor chose Ace. Like, you get hints of that throughout. Like, there's a scene in Silver Nemesis where the Doctor and Ace are just in a mathematician's study, and the Doctor just looks at a chessboard which is halfway through played and just moves a piece to signify his ongoing game with Fenric. And then I guess this is where it really starts, that he kind of just mentally abuses Ace and like two stories across. And it's a wonder, really, she stays with him afterwards. It's like he has to win her back, especially in the Curse of Fenric. And it's just where the whole era was leading to. And then they end up cutting it short and we just never get more.
But I think it works as a final season. I think it's really interesting that even though they had more bigger plans, you know, you start with a Brigadier, you get Lethbridge Stewart back, that great icon of Doctor Who, and you do a lovely fitting, wonderful, lovely story. I love Battlefield. It's the weakest of the four stories, I think, for me.
Which tells you how great a season it is.
Well, exactly, yeah. It's great. It's fun. You've got Unit back, a new modern era with Bambera. And the Brigadier's back, and it's lovely and warm and coming, but it's also got a mystery with the whole idea of Doctor as Merlin, and there's some great stuff there with the Destroyer and so on. It's a really, really fun action pack, but also lovely knowing of its past as well. Then you get obviously the completely bonkers mysteries of Ghost Lock, right? You get the resolution of Ace in the Curse of Fenric and the battle with Fenric itself, which you find has been seeding through since Dragonfire. And then you get the finale, which brings back the Master. And I would say is Anthony Aney's best performance as the Master, yes, as well, when he's slightly cat-like, yes, himself. And that kind of literally ends with the Doctor and the Master battling each other on a crumbling planet. I think that is a great iconic moment, which is kind of the culmination of their story as well. So, I mean, as much as I like the way they wander into the distance and the fields with a voiceover as well, which is a lovely way to end it, I think, because they obviously didn't have the... I wonder maybe they'd have more definite if they knew it was definitely the end. But I think I like the open-endedness, yeah, of it. But you get these callbacks to early Doctor Who, to the Master, to the Brigadier. You wrap up Ace's storyline, you get the kind of resolution on Fenric as well. All these points for like hitting what Cartman was trying to do from the beginning come into play in that final season.
Yeah, and like only 14 episodes as well, 14 half-hour episodes.
Yeah, staggering amount of content covered in those episodes.
Well, I was going to bring back to something Ben said there, which I thought was really interesting, and I think we haven't really touched on, which is the idea that you have, that the relationship between the Doctor and Ace is, I think, very deliberately problematized by this, by the show. I think the show, like, historically, the dynamic between the Doctor and Companion has traditionally been the Doctor is the boss and the Companion is the sidekick. And that's the way it works. The Doctor knows how to fly the TARDIS, generally speaking, and the Companion is along for the ride and kind of deferential. That Terence Dix quote about how, you know, the Companion's role is to, like, hold test tubes and tell the Doctor how smart he is. That's very reductive. It doesn't necessarily sum up all Companions. I think if you look at, say, Romana II in particular, she's a much more dynamic Companion, and she leaves the show arguably as the Doctor's equal, going off with K-9 to have her own Doctor-like adventures. But generally speaking, there's been this, like, breakdown of like power in the TARDIS that comes to the Doctor is the one who controls the TARDIS, the Doctor is the one who controls the narrative, the Companion is largely deferential to that and subject to the whims of the Doctor. And I think what's interesting, and again this ties back to what we mentioned about this idea of, you know, interrogating children's television, and also the way in which the show references this kind of Victoriana kind of adventuring stuff, you know, things like Captain Cook, the fantasy of like imperialist adventurers, that sort of stuff, where you get this sense the Doctor is, as Ben said, maybe a little bit abusive towards Ace. The way in which he treats Ace is maybe not okay. And I think the show is aware of that, and I think that's very clever. Things like, for example, Ghostlight, where like the Doctor drags Ace backwards in time to confront a trauma from her own childhood without asking her, without consulting with her, without telling her that that's what he's doing. He just decides that is what's best for her, and then forces her to confront this thing from her childhood that she never wanted to face. Things like the Curse of Fenric, where he literally has to break her faith in him. He has to manipulate her to a point where she trusts him, and then she has to break that trust in order for him to win this game that he's playing with Fenric. And I think, you know, thematically that's important because it suggests that, like, the doctor and companion relationship should be something akin to an apprenticeship, which I would argue is like a theme that carries on when Davis and Moffat take over, where you have things like, you know, Rose gets to be kind of the doctor of her Torchwood Earth, for example, and things like, you know, Clara gets to go off in a TARDIS with me, for example, and, you know, obviously Bill gets to join the pilot and they go off and have cool lesbian space adventures together. And it's treated as like the doctor's companion is an apprenticeship. You leave at the end and you are more qualified and you get to have your own adventures. But I do also think that the show is, and I think this ties back to the kind of Cartmel master plan, the question of it, which is the doctor a good guy underneath it all? And I know this is something that the new adventures pick up with. And I know that the new adventures arguably push the idea well past its logical extreme. But I think that, like, even when you watch the show, there's something very interesting about the presentation of the doctor here, because it arguably taps back to the earliest characterization under Hartnell, which is, can I trust this guy? And should Ace trust this guy? And is trusting this guy, you know, who is we trust is doing things for the right reason, who we trust is like fighting evil across the universe. As Ben pointed out, the fact that the Seventh Doctor is actively proactive, which is interesting, like where he's constantly making references to, oh, I always meant to get around that. Oh, well, you know, tonight's the night sort of thing. Oh, I've been meaning to visit there for ages, where it feels like he's kind of he is acting with motivation in a way that his predecessors really haven't been. But we trust that he's doing the right thing. He's deposing autocrats. He's like toppling Helen A, for example. He's defeating Fenric. But like, is traveling with the doctor the healthiest thing for Ace? And I think the show asked that question. And I think that that's very clever and very bold. But I want to get your read on that. So Ben, Baz, like, is there, like, what do you think of that? Is that ambiguity there in the show? And is that a good thing? Is it interesting? Does the show explore it? What do you think?
I mean, oh yeah, it very much is there throughout. And it, I guess it picks up probably a bit more in the V&As and I presume the DWM comics, which I haven't read. Season 27 doesn't really pick up on that too much. We'll get around to that in a few minutes, I think. But over on the screen, yeah, it's very clearly played, yet also quite subtle.
Yeah, I think she's completely broken in the events of Ghostlight and Curse of Fenric, and then kind of the homecoming is an interesting point of survival, that she comes home and she is the absolute natural point then when she could leave, and she doesn't. And it's almost like she goes for that trial by fire and then decides to stay. That's how I kind of read what happens in survival, because, you know, she could go back to her old life, possibly become a cheater person. She gets corrupted herself like all the others and become like everyone else on the estate, or she can go off on these wacky adventures with the doctor. And I think that's ultimately what she's by his side at the end, and that's what she chooses to do. So I think there's still a bit of an ambiguity, but and that's what, going back to what we said earlier on as well, I like the ambiguity of the cult master plan, for example, that how you don't really get those definite answers. And actually, you don't necessarily want those answers either. You like, I like that Cartmell imbues a doctor with a certain amount of mystery again.
Yeah.
You know, he's not quite as familiar as it may have been previously. And certainly Ace suffers as a result of that as well. Certainly she's very much a pawn in the game. This chess game is happening over the course of the three seasons, really. But I think she becomes stronger by it and chooses to stay with the doctor, I think, as a result of that, which is interesting given the season 27 plan, which would she would have become an apprentice on Gallifrey, an apprentice Time Lord. So that was always the goal for Ace. And I know that Big Finish has used Ace post season 26 multiple times, and she's very much involved in the Gallifrey stuff as well. So there's elements of that do feed through, but I think it's that she struggles, she suffers through it, becomes stronger as a result, and then by choosing to stay, the next step is then, like Clara, for example, with the TARDIS, she goes on to become a Time Lord herself.
Yeah.
I remember reading in one of the Doctor Who magazine comic collections, I think it's the one for the Flood, where I think it was Clayton Hickman or Scott Gray, it was one of them, said they went to a talk in like 2004-ish time when the revival was happening. And I think it was Russell T Davies there. And he said, like, for the first time ever, the show was going to have two main leads. And when you think about that, that is just completely incorrect. because that would, that he's trying to insinuate like the Ninth Doctor and Rose are the first equal sort of partnership in terms of leads on the show. But actually, Ace really set the template for the Modern Who companion. She is the first one to really properly become a main character other than just the traveling companion.
Yeah, I think there were others too. You mentioned Romana too, absolutely. Mm. Romana too, particularly more so than Romana one, is very much the Doctor's equal on the side there. You know, there's arguably elements of the latter end of the Sarah and Fourth Doctor as well, when they are best mates, Tron and TARDIS, and I think they almost become equals themselves, but she's never quite at the Doctor's level, obviously. Yeah. But I think, yeah, Ace is the proto-modern companion. I think she's the one. I understand what Russell Davies was saying, was that, you know, it's very much the companion story as much as the Doctor's story now. But I think that's where Ace and the Doctor were going. Ace and the Seventh Doctor were that relationship. And maybe we would have seen a bit more of that if there'd been another season.
I do also think that maybe, like, the fact that, you know, Rose Dyer is played by Billy Piper may also have been a factor there as well, where, like, Christopher Eccleston is a phenomenal actor and like, reasonably well-known in British circles and an actor's actor and respected, but Billy Piper is a star. Billy Piper, is, you know, like, even at that stage was, like, and again, arguably you can trace back the roots of the variety performer back to people like Bonnie Langford, for example. I do think, though, there is something interesting in the idea, and again, this gets back to the Cartmel Master Plan thing, where it makes the Doctor more mysterious. And I think one of the smarter aspects of that is that it decides that the way that it can afford to make the Doctor more mysterious and more ambiguous and more unknowable is to do the opposite, is to make the companion more knowable and more centric and more dynamic. So Ace, you know, again, and I say this, I love Romana too. I love a lot of the earlier companions as well. Ace is arguably the first companion to have a proper arc. And it's kind of ironic because obviously, you know, the orders in which those episodes were shot was not the order in which they were intended to be aired, is not the episode in which they were aired. And there are discussions among fans about, like, whether you should watch The Curse of Fenric before Ghostlight or Ghostlight before Curse of Fenric if you want to get the best effect of her arc. But I do think that, like, she does have an arc. And I think that it's a very clever way for the show to realize that, like, look, Doctor Who is always going to have the central character of Doctor Who is always going to be the Doctor. Like, it's in the title, as much as certain fans may or may not like that idea that the title character is the Doctor, meaning his name may in fact be his or her name may be Doctor Who. But the idea that, yeah, the Doctor will always essentially be a part of Doctor Who, and the companion is the part that you can rotate in and out. And that means that the companion can always be constantly changing. You can characterize a companion. A companion can have an arc. A companion can have a story. And that story can start, evolve, and end. And that companion's done, and you've told a complete story. Whereas the Doctor, you can't do that because the Doctor will always be there. They'll be making Doctor Who in 100 years from now, and the Doctor will still be there, presumably, and will still be the same character. And I think that that's hugely important as well, is the idea that Ace is almost like the central character of the era, because she's the one who does grow and who does change, and who, while the Doctor becomes less knowable and more mysterious, she becomes, like, more knowable, more psychologically complex, more motivated, more developed, more central. And I think, as you both point out, like, that is a template for how Davies certainly approaches companions. And, you know, I would argue Moffat does as well. I think, like, Amy and I think Clara very much fit that bill as well. So, yeah, I think that's an interesting kind of, like, the flip side, that when you talk about the Cartmel plan and how it changes the character of the Doctor and it changes the dynamic of the show, it's important to look at the flip side and say that also means that you shift the relationship of the companion accordingly to accommodate for it, I think.
Definitely. I think we've covered the three seasons of The Seventh Doctor, but I want to talk a bit about the continuations in other forms as well, particularly Lungbow and kind of the ideas that will evolve from the Cartmel Master Plan as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much you know about that.
No, I'm less familiar than you are.
I'm not, I know, I am not pretending to be. Right. I know I'm going to defer okay. to Ben on
we're,
that.
We're going to say, Ben, over to you.
Okay.
Yeah, Ben, no, do.
I've listened to season 27, but I haven't really read any V&As, but I know enough about them. The Doctor Who magazine, comics, I think, they just continue it, push on. Like, Andrew Cartmel wrote a few, gave a new TARDIS interior and so on. But season 27, what I like about it is, while it does pick up loads of the plot strands, like, for example, new companion, I really like Rain as a companion, it continues like Ace being enlisted into the academy, but Big Finish make the executive decision to drop that. So rather than it being over the course of the series, it's all in that first story, Thin Ice, and ultimately she's rejected. And also it's nice to have, as like an arc running through it with Rain and the Metatraxi. And Andrew Cartmell wrote a few of them, like Animal, I know, which brings back Bambira, which is like, I guess it's his natural continuation of what he was doing without fully going there, because at this point these audios were like 2011 and obviously Show was back, Matt Smith was in charge.
So these are all Big Finish audios, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Thin Ice, not the Capaldi one. Crime of the Century, Animal and Earth Aid. And yeah, they all have, well, not all of them, Thin Ice doesn't, but the other three have Rain in them, new companion who joins Doctor and Ace, and presumably when Ace was going to leave, and I think McCoy was going to leave at the end of season 27 as well, Rain would probably have continued on with the Eighth Doctor, for example. But yeah, and then we get to the V&As, which is like them trying to push Doctor Who into the really more adult and dark direction. And I'm sure either both of you, or at least one of you, probably know some of the themes they go is a bit... It's very controversial in fan circles.
Yeah, these are the Virgin New Adventures book, yeah.
Yes, like yeah. The first yeah. book essentially has Ace apparently being raped and the Doctor's just like, respect the time period we're in, which is always a bit iffy in fan circles. Yeah. And there's some more stuff like that throughout a lot of them, but it also very much continues the Doctor's dark arc. Like, Ace comes and goes a lot in those books, and obviously we get... Bernie Summerfield joins. And what you were saying about the Doctor always going to be there, the main character, but then also we have Ace, whether one of the novels, Birthright, is the first Doctor Light story. That book, like, he's off doing whatever yeah. thing he's off doing. And Ace and Bernice are the protagonists of that novel, which again sets template for a modern Doctor Who and proves how Ace is a strong enough character in her own right to continue with that. Story, yeah. And then it goes on, obviously we get Human Nature, the original version, and then Ace leaves for good, Bernice is there, Chris and Roz come on, Bernice leaves, I think Roz leaves at one point, I think she dies in one of them, not entirely sure. And then we get ultimately to Lungbarrow, which is like Seven and Chris together, and then that's all two canines, Leela, Ace, Romana. Actually, no, not Ace. Just Leela, Romana, and, like, the Doctor's... Essentially what the Cartman Master Plan's building to, like,
yeah.
the Doctor's house where he was loomed,
yes.
getting into all this spicy lore now. I like to think of Lungbarrow as the cursed text of Doctor Who. Like, there's one yeah. weird bit where apparently it insinuates Leela might be the Doctor's mother. Which is, right. that's interesting, half human.
I love that there's no response to that. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. Half like, human on okay. his mother's
yeah,
side.
Yeah.
Fair, but yeah, like where the Doctor was born, the one place he never wanted to visit again, goes into stuff like the other. And yeah, essentially, it's described really as the finale of all classic Who.
Yeah. Well, it like again, I'm going to defer to Ben on this because my knowledge of this is all kind of largely secondhand and research done years ago. But if I remember correctly, isn't Lungbarrow meant to be kind of the end of that era of Doctor Who, and it's meant to segue neatly into the movie? Am I correct in saying that?
I think Lungbarrow eventually ended up being published in
around
2003, maybe. So yeah. Probably had to know,
but I think, like, in terms of internal continuity, isn't it meant to be? Isn't that meant to be the Seventh Doctor just before?
Yeah, I think. I'm not sure if okay. Chris leaves or not. If they just keep him on, okay. but I don't think there's anything within post that. And then, obviously, you get, and after that, really, all the Big Finish and Doctor Who magazine stuff in between. It's just Seven basically on his own, leading up to the movie. And here's the most ironic death of any Doctor. Like, the manipulative master game player who plays with people's lives to save the universe dies because he forgets to check a scanner.
Okay. It did have a weird ending for the Seventh Doctor, absolutely. But I think that the TV movie is probably a discussion for another day, absolutely.
But yeah, so essentially Lungbarrow is the culmination of all that with the other and his origins, essentially, which is done differently to the Timeless Child, people will probably be happy to know, he is still a Time Lord.
Yeah.
Again, though, that's the thing, is that, like, I think Baz kind of mentioned early on, but, like, I was watching the Timeless Child and I was thinking, this feels like the logical culmination of the Cartmel Master Plan, mm-hmm. where it's like, you've been setting up this mystery. And again, going back to the 13th Doctor's second episode, where, like, the floating rags say the mystery of the Timeless Child and the idea that it's kind of seeded through. And you answer that question, and the answer is always going to be frustrating, because even if it's a good answer, it's going to contradict what everybody always assumed or thought, or what the audience kind of wanted. And you end up, like, the answer is never as satisfying as the question, which is, again, arguably a common problem with things like mystery box shows. But I think it's particularly a problem with something like Doctor Who, where it would be one thing if the first Doctor had been introduced and he was like, yeah, here's Susan, here's the family tree, here's the names of Susan's parents, we're going to visit them, here's my home planet, here's everything you want to know from the outset. Mm. But the fact that, like, you spent years building to, you know, the Time Lords not really showing up until you get to the War Games. Yeah. Things like not actually visiting Gallifrey until, I think, like, arguably the Three Doctors, but you can go even kind of further than that and say, like, you know, the Deadly Assassin perhaps is probably the point at which, like, you really kind of anchor it. I think, is the Three Doctors set on, like, when is Gallifrey first named? There's a question, actually.
I mean, TV comic apparently revealed it and called it Jewel for some reason. So that's another name for Gallifrey now. But yeah, Gallifrey was in the Three Doctors in the Time Lord bit. But yeah, I don't think it's named until the Time Warrior. And yeah, the Doctor never visits it until Deadly Assassin. So that's really when Gallifrey first comes in full force.
So you've had so long to have these questions kind of build, and then any answer you provide is going to contradict, like, what fans think and what fans want. And it's going to make the universe smaller rather than bigger. And I think, like, that's what I love about the Cartmel Master Plan we actually got, as opposed to the one that was realized in Lung Barrow, which is the idea that it pushes the boundaries out and it just gives more.
Yeah.
It invites the possibility that, like, anything is possible. You can like, the show can go in any direction from here. The Doctor can be anything or anyone. He's not just this person you spent 25 years with and you feel like you know inside and out. He has mysteries and surprises inside him, and you don't really know him at all, which is amazing when you have spent 25 years with somebody. Like, which is kind of, that's what I love about it. And I think, yeah, I think you're right about pointing to Lung Barrow as a cursed text, because there's no way you can answer those questions and have it be satisfying, I think. Which, and again, that's not a knock on the Timeless Child. I feel like the Timeless Child is in an impossible, the Timeless Children's in an impossible situation. I feel like there was no way for Chibnall to do something like that would satisfy people. I don't think the answer is wrong. I think trying to answer is wrong, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I agree. So one final question then before we wrap up there, and without going too much into Chibnall's Doctor Who, and certainly there'll be a post-mortem episode to follow after the Centenary special, but given what we got on TV, so excluding Lung Barrow and all that stuff, what we got on TV and the mystery of Guy and the Seventh Doctor, does it kind of work with the Timeless Children, given that kind of is almost like a natural conclusion of the mystery set up here?
I mean, the thing is, though, the implication is that the Doctor knows at least something about his mysterious past and the Cartmel Master Plan. Like, the Doctor is also dropping hints about, oh, I'm far more than just another Time Lord. And I don't think that works with the Timeless Children, because the Timeless Children is a mystery even to the Doctor themselves.
Mm. Although then we do have, bear in mind, this is McCoy. He apparently knows the Time War's coming, so I don't think it's too much of a stretch to assume all Doctors have a memory block other than Seven. And he's like, nope. No,
he knows stuff, I think.
Yeah,
maybe, like, that's it. Yeah,
like it, I love, like, this. There's one story where it insinuates the Seventh Doctor's dormant personality.
Yeah, murdered.
He was just so insistent to be born, he's the one who got the Sixth Doctor killed.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Seven's quite a rogue element.
Yeah, to kind of sort of semi quote Tyrion from Game of Thrones, I'm a doctor and I know things. I think that's the Seventh Doctor.
that kind of makes sense. I do love the idea of like the Seventh Doctor, like not just tormenting like Ace, not just torturing Ace, not just, but like literally tormenting kind of himself. And again, like you could argue that like Paul Cornell in I think the New Adventures kind of explored that. I think like, isn't there a story with the Fifth Doctor, a novel with the Fifth Doctor, where you have this contrast between the earlier version of the Doctor and the Seventh Doctor, and you get the sense the Seventh Doctor is the kind of version of the Doctor that the Doctor themselves doesn't like.
Yeah,
you could
Lance Parkin wrote that Cold Fusion. I've not read it, but I've listened to the Big Finish adaptation, and I'm not sure that's in there hugely, but it's definitely still an element.
Definitely, yeah. There's a lot of mystery to the Seventh Doctor, and I kind of like that. Absolutely.
I kind of like the idea that, yeah, like something like the 11th Doctor's character arc is arguably a response to the 7th Doctor, you could say. Like where you have this idea of the 11th Doctor kind of learning that he shouldn't treat people like pawns, that he should like respect their autonomy and like not lie to Clara continuously as he manipulates her like a chess piece.
Yeah.
So I can see that. I can see the 7th Doctor existing as like a limit case for the Doctor. So yeah, maybe that works in that
absolutely
sense.
Absolutely. So I think that's probably a really good place to end actually there. So thank you so much, Dan, for coming on and talking Doctor with us. If people want to find and talk more Doctor or TV and film in general, where can we find you online?
Yeah, okay. Well, first thing I should probably actually plug is that I'm doing an edition of the Black Archives, which I don't know if you guys have talked about.
Yeah, I was searching TARDIS Wiki the other day and I just was randomly on the Black Archives and I saw your name pop up next to Kill the Moon, I think it is.
Yeah,
and I was just like, oh, okay, well, I have to discuss that on the podcast.
That's happening. Yeah. Don't worry, I'm as surprised as you are, Ben, so it's grand. But no, I got in touch with the editor, got in touch with me, and he asked would I like to write a book length exploration of a Doctor Who story, and I was like, yeah, sure. And he was like, which one? And I was like, Kill the Moon. And he's like, are you sure? And I'm like, yes. So I think I've been working back and forth with the editors on this. I think it's a really good piece. It's hopefully coming out, I think, sometime around June. So I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but feel free to kind of like order it online, read it online, ask your local library to order in a copy, buy a copy for yourself, buy a copy for your significant other, buy a copy for your friends, buy a copy for your dog. Just, buy copies.
Everyone loves Kill the Moon, which everyone, it's an underrated episode.
I like it. Yeah.
Kill the Moon is a masterpiece, but that's a discussion that we do not have time to get into.
We'll get you back on for Kill the Moon at some point in the future. That's set in stone now.
Exactly.
That's it. Yeah. It's carved in the moon with a giant laser.
Start with Ghost Light, end with Kill the Moon.
That is very on brand for me. I apologize, guys. But yeah, outside of that, so outside of like defending Kill the Moon and Ghost Light, apparently, you can find me online as kind of Baz mentioned. I host a podcast called The 250 with my good friend Andrew. We go through the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. Do we know roughly when this is?
It's mid-March.
Okay, so in March, we'll be in the middle of our season covering the films of Francis Ford Coppola, because obviously The Godfather is being re-released in cinemas in March to mark its 50th anniversary. So myself and Andrew will be talking through the first three Godfather movies, The Conversation and Apocalypse Now in March. So you can check those out if you want to. Other than that, I'm available on Twitter at Darren_Mooney. I write at The Escapist magazine, so just Google my name and The Escapist. I write a couple of columns weekly there covering geek culture. And yeah, just come yell at me on movies or Doctor Who and all that sort of stuff online.
Brilliant, fab. While you're plugging books, I'll plug my books, my Doctor Who books. So I've written a couple of the books for Candy Jar, the Left with Stuart book. So there's Forward to the Past, which came out a couple of years ago, and probably around now, I think The Unit Files is coming out, which is a series of short stories set around the Brigadier in Benton. And I've written one of those. So it was great fun to write for Benton on that character. So that should be out now as well. That's from Candijar Books. And obviously you can also find me on various podcasts on We Made This. And you can also find me on Twitter at Baz Greenland. And if you want to follow the TARDIS crew and find more about us, you can find us by searching Crew TARDIS on Twitter and Instagram too. So thank you for joining us for our latest episode. And remember, we are part of the We Made This podcast network. Please subscribe to the TARDIS crew and give us a rating and review on our podcast. We'd really love to hear your thoughts on that. And if you want to help out our network, please consider supporting us on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. Doctor is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what else you might have missed on the network in a moment.
There are worlds out there where the sky is burning, where the seas asleep and the rivers dream. People made of smoke and cities made of song. Some of there's danger, some of there's injustice, and somewhere else the tea's getting cold. Come on, Ace, We've got work to do.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Academy Watch, a prestige film podcast.
A lot of these other characters that are not human have these bizarre names, non-Anglo names. And then we have Paul.
I mean, I kind of wanted a Brian or a Gary to rock up next to him as well.
Like a Gary, like a real like Scouse guy from...
I was about to do a Scouse accent, but then I thought better of it.
Yeah, let's leave the Scouse. We've already offended the Pauls. Let's leave the Garys alone.
Pick a disc.
Everyone was sort of caught up in the cowboyness of the post 9/11 world. Like to an extent, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, George W. Bush basically took on the role of John Wayne. He was like, "I'm going to find them and I'm going to catch them and I'm going to put them to justice," that sort of thing. And I think for a long while that had kind of been accepted, and that was okay. You can lead us forward. You know what you're doing. And then, you know, some other things began happening and other wheels started turning. And that's where I think this album managed to land, was there were a load of people that were thinking about, is this right? Should we be doing this? And it kind of validated that school of thought, because it said it in such an eloquent way. And it's very, very pointed at, you know, its administrations and its message of anti-war, not necessarily anti this war, but anti all wars.
Right in the childhood.
There's other boy bands, include the likes of McFly. McFly was a big one.
I remember McFly.
McFly Busted.
McFly was shit busted.
Oh, that's a controversial.
I could name five or eight. Well.
Here we go, because I'm a big Busted in McFly.
I could name three or four Busted songs. I could name you no McFly songs.
Name me some Busted.
Year 3000.
Yeah.
Shit me, I'm sure I know more than Year 3000.
Glad I Crashed the Wedding.
Yeah, that one.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network.